Yeah, first I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me the chance to give this talk here. So I will talk about definable versions of theorems by Kirsch, Brown, and Helly. So the question is how to start. And let's start with the year 1934. So, well, what is the year 1934? It is a good year for extending functions. So first we have some things of Whitney and McShane. And this is not a joint paper. These are two different papers, but both are in 1934. And, well, McShane's paper is directly about extending Lipschitz continuous functions, and Whitney's paper is about extending continuously differentiable functions. And what is in those two papers? There's the following theorem. Well, let A subset Rn be closed. F from A to R L Lipschitz. Well, then f of x, which is the infimum over all a in a of the following expression, L times, what do we have? X minus a plus f of a extends f to Rn as L Lipschitz function. Well, this is in 1934, and well, in the Whitney paper it's just a footnote on the first page, just very simple. If you do have a modulus of continuity and we put this modulus of continuity in here, so this is my Lipschitz continuity, and we take this construction, then everything works fine. This is an L Lipschitz function and extends F to the whole Rn. And McShane, in a different paper, gave a detailed proof of that, and Whitney is just a footnote. So, but I will talk about theorems of Kirsch, Brown, and Helly. So why Kirsch, Brown? And while McShane, Whitney is North America, let's say it this way, on the other side of the ocean, there was Kirsch, Brown. And that's also in 1934. And what does Kirsch-Brown say? Well, let A subset Rn be closed. And F from A to R to the power of K L Lipschitz. Then there is an L Lipschitz function capital F from Rn to Rk such that F equals F on A. I hope everybody can see this. So what is the big difference between those two? Well, first of all, Whitney-McShane construction is perfectly explicit, and we can easily write it down. And Kirsch-Brown theorem, well, is not just going to the real numbers, it's to the r at the power of k. So if you compare those two constructions, we see immediately from Whitney-McShain, we get a weak Kirsch-Brown theorem. Because, well, taking this construction here, component-wise, we obtain by Whitney and McShain, well, not really an L Lipschitz function, capital F, but a square root of K times L Lipschitz function from Rn to Rk, extending F. So the great advantage of Kirsch-Brown theorem is that it preserves the constant. While the Whitney-McShain construction only preserves a constant if our target space are the real numbers. Well, but there is one big problem about Kirsch-Brown's proof. Or it's not really a problem, but we will see why it's interesting to us. So let's give a short idea of the proof of Kirsch-Brown's theorem. So, idea of proof. So then what Kirsch-Brown was looking at was the following. Well, for F having an L Lipschitz extension, we need the following, and this can be easily written down as the intersection over all members of our function f, and then we have the y in Rk such that y minus f of a is less than or equal L times, this is x minus a. So that this set is not empty and x ranges over all elements of Rn. So what is this precisely? Well, it's simply, for fixed A, this is simply the ball with radius L times x minus A and center f of A. And of course, if we want to extend, let's say, to the point x, this set must definitely be non-empty, because I take the intersection over all elements of my domain that I was given. And, there should be some y minus f of a such that this is less than L times x minus a. Because this is the usual thing, my y is then my value at x, and I want to have f of x minus f of a, the norm of that is less than L times the Euclidean distance. So that is what we need, at least it is necessary, for having an extension. So, but to check whether this is non-empty for every x or not, is a priori not obvious. And then Kirsch-Brown thought, let's look at some papers of Helly. And this is where the Helly theorem comes into play. So Kirsch-Brown said, use Helly. And this is from 1912. And that tells us the following. Let, C be a family of sets and these sets are not just sets, they are compact and convex subsets of, well, what do we have here? It's R n. So if any collection of at most n plus 1 sets from C has non-empty intersection, then the intersection over all elements in CA is not empty. So in other words, Helly's theorem tells us, well, we just have to check this for, well, finite subsets of our capital A. And this is also known as the finite intersection property. And Helly gives us actually a number, and this is dimension plus 1. If we are in n space, we need n plus 1 of these sets. And this n plus 1 is actually sharp. We cannot do it just looking at n sets of this. Well, so that means getting this non-empty, just look at finite sets. Well, now I cheat a little bit. I say it's rather simple to check that for finite collections of these sets, we have non-empty intersection. So it's rather simple to show that the intersection A in A prime, CA and A prime, is just an empty set, that this is not the empty set. This just means a cardinality.
And this
yeah. Well, okay. Well, I don't want to have any suggestion. Well, we want to show that the intersection of all the sets is non-empty, so especially of n plus 2 of these sets. So, well, so this is rather simple. Well, it's not really simple, but it's, let's say, easy, but I will not do this on the blackboard to show that. And well, then, what was Kirsch-Brown's final step in the proof? So, well, Kirsch-Brown shows his family up there has non-empty intersection. So he assumes, well, assume F from, let's say, A tilde to RK is an L Lipschitz extension of F such that A tilde is maximal. Well, such an extension always exists by Soren-Lember. We can always say, okay, we have here all the subsets of A, and well, we take such a subset where we do have an L Lipschitz extension of F, and of course the subsets are partially ordered, so we have maximal elements in there. So by Soren-Lember we do have such an A tilde. And now, suppose A tilde is not the whole N space. Well, that means there is B in Rn without A tilde, and, well, let's call it X. And we call this, let's say, Bx. And there is a Y in Dx, because this is non-empty. And then G from A tilde with X to Rk, where G equals capital F on A tilde, and G of X equals Y, is an L. Lipschitz extension of F. But we assumed that A tilde is maximal, and this contradicts it. So A tilde is Rn. Question so far? Yeah. The Y I take from here. Well, in this case it's then A tilde. Well, maybe this Kirschbaum idea forced Chris Miller to ask, do we have the Kirschbaum theorem in all member structures or not? And, well, of course, we do have, otherwise I wouldn't stand here. So, what is the big problem? Well, we see here the Sorn lemma is a very big problem, because it doesn't give us any clue how to construct such a function. And also this Helly theorem, it looks so innocent, but actually it uses the finite subcover property of compact sets. So these are two theorems which, well, in the statement they sound innocent, but when you look at the proofs, they're not very good. Well, no, they are good, but they're not very good from the viewpoint of model theory. Where is the... So, the next thing is, when we look at Helly's theorem, because this seems to be the first that we should prove if we want to try to prove the Kirschbaum theorem, what does bother us in the Helly theorem? So first of all, the word compact, well, we know if you talk about all member structures, compact is usually replaced by closed and bounded. Convex is no problem at all, it's first order, and then this intersection is non-empty. Well, from now on, we work over a real closed field and we fix some M, a definitely complete expansion, definitely complete expansion of this real closed field. Well, Miller's question was about all minimal structures, but actually we do not need all minimal. The only thing is we need definitely complete, and what does that mean? every definable bounded subset of R has the least upper bound. Or alternatively, we have the intermediate value theorem for definable continuous functions. But well, here we talk about Lipschitz geometry, so we like more least upper bounds and such things. So definably complete expansion, well, examples, all O-minimal expansions are definably complete. Well, if you talk O-minimal expansion, I mean of a real closed field. And all expansions of the real field are definably complete. Well, that's quite nice. In this sense, Henle theorem can be easily stated, and I need still this. So we can reformulate Henle's theorem, and what does it look like? Let C equals CA, A element A, B a definable family of closed and bounded convex sets. Well, of Rn. Well, if any collection of n plus 1 sets has non-empty intersection then the whole thing has non-empty intersection. Well, we're working at a definably complete expansion of the real closed field, and it is essential that we take definable family of closed and bounded convex sets. It is not enough if we have just a family of closed and bounded definable sets, then this intersection property does not work at all. It's also essential that the sets are bounded, because you can just take, let's say, on the real line all the half-closed intervals starting at a natural number and ending at infinity. They all have the finite intersection property, but the intersection over all sets is non-empty. And, well, closed is also required for sort of obvious reasons. So, but the original proof of Henle's theorem uses the finite subcover property of compact sets. That is not really good if we work over definably complete structures, when we're not over the real numbers. And so what is the general idea of the proof? I will not give a proof because that's a little bit too technical. So the general idea is the following. First of all, we can assume that the union of all our closed and bounded convex sets is actually bounded. In reality, this is not always the case, but since at least we can just take one of these CAs and intersect it with any other things, then we have such a family which has bounded union. So we may assume that the union over all A, CA, is a bounded set. Because we are actually interested in intersections, so we can always assume that. And then consider the function D from Rn to 0 infinity. And this is D of x is the supremum over all A in A, and then we take the distance of x to CA. So what distance means the Euclidean distance, and we have a supremum of convex functions, because the distance function 2 and z is always convex, and the pointwise supremum of a family of convex functions is again convex, and everything is definable in here, so we are happy. And since this is a convex function, it has, and it's a bounded function, it has definitely a global minimum. And well, D is definable, convex and bounded. So there is a global minimum at, well, x0. And now this is the concept we just have to show. Well, show that D of x0 is actually 0. Well, it's bounded. Well, oh, bounded, yeah. From below. So, as soon as this is not trivial, actually, to show that the minimum is 0. But as soon as D of x0 is 0, as soon as we have it, then the supremum of all the distances from x0 to any of the CA is 0. Well, that means x0 is contained in any of these sets, because these sets are all closed. So this is an optimization problem. It's a little bit technical to prove, but one can prove it. And one does not use compactness or anything else. So we have a definable version of the Halley theorem. This is the easy part, or the part where we know what we do have to do. But the other problem is Kirsch-Brown's idea using Zorn lemma. And if you look at the literature, until 2008, in any version of Kirsch-Brown's theorem, I mean it's valid from Hilbert space to Hilbert space, from some Banach spaces with some extra conditions to Euclidean spaces and so on, one always checks that you do have such a finite intersection property for, well, I erased this set, for the set dx, which was the intersection of all these sets, and then this proof. It's always this. Just until very recently, and this is due to Bauschke and Wang. And this is from, well, it's written in 2008, it's not yet published, but preprint exists and it's accepted and everything. And they have thought a little bit how to prove this without Zorn lemma. And, well, they proved it from Hilbert space into Hilbert space, and but there are some ideas that translate easily to definably complete structures, and some ideas where you have to do really work that it works. And what is the construction of Bauschke and Wang? And for that, you need lots of space. So Bauschke and Wang, they're actually from convex analysis, and they actually use convex functions to prove Kirschbaum's theorem. And they remember Minty's work from the 60s. And while I translated immediately into definably complete structures. So, and what was Minty thinking about? So, Minty more or less founded monotone operator theory. And what does that mean for us? Well, a map T from Rn into the power set of Rn. And in short, we write T from Rn, and we have here a double arrow to Rn. It's called definable. If the family is definable. That's the first thing. And, well, then we use some abuse of notation, and we say the graph of T is the set X and X star in Rn times Rn, such that X star belongs to T of X. Well, nothing yet has happened. And then is Minty definition. He says that X and X star in Rn times Rn are monotonically related to T if X minus Y, X star minus Y star is greater or equal to 0 for all Y, Y star in the graph of T. Well, this is actually the key point of Minty's idea. So if you look at this in a different form, well, let's say our T is simply a function from R to R, and then we look at this, then this condition simply says that our function is monotonically increasing. Because X minus Y, and here, if X is greater than Y, then F of X shall be greater than F of Y. So this is what is written here. But the whole thing can be defined on Euclidean spaces and even on Hilbert spaces. But we are interested in this situation. and we call t is maximal if there is no xx star in Rn times Rn without the graph of t, which is monotonically related to t. Yeah? That's no question? Yeah. So what does this have to do with the Kirsch-Brown theorem? And this can be seen by Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, because, well, we start with f from A to, let's say, Rn L Lipschitz. Well, there is no problem. This constant L does not really bother us. We can always say, well, replace f by f divided by L. We may assume that f is 1 Lipschitz. This is not a big deal. And then the next thing is, and then we will see why this condition is so interesting. 1 Lipschitz is also called non-expansive. And then Minty thought, well, non-expansive is not strong enough. I want to have firmly non-expansive. So f from Rn to Rn is firmly non-expansive if f of x minus f of y square is less than or equal to x minus y f of x minus f of y. And there we already see, oh yeah, there's a similar condition. And what is the relation between monotonically related definable maps into the power set? And we have small proposition, which is essentially due to Minty, that Minty in the 60s was not interested in model theory. And that's the following. So let f from x to Rn, and x is actually a subset of Rn, be definable. And t from Rn to Rn, so this is now our operator, given by, well, f is the same as my operator. Well, I can always add the identity function to this. Well, if I evaluate at x, then this is t of x, this is a subset shifted by the number x, and I take the inverse function of that. Well, there is no real big deal. We know that t goes from Rn to the power set of Rn, so we know what means inverse function. And we have this nice relation. Then we have two statements. T is monotone and of course definable if and only if f is firmly non-expansive. And that is a good news, because we have a direct relation between this monotone operators and firmly non-expansive maps. And more crucial is, he is maximal monotone if and only if, well, F is firmly non-expansive and X is actually the whole Rn. And this is Minty's really good idea. This is the basic, more or less the basic theorem for monotone operator theory. So, now we have reduced the problem to definable maximal monotone operators. And what does it help? Well, Minty founded monotone operator theory, and others were interested in that too. Especially Mr. Fitzpatrick. And he defined the so-called Fitzpatrick function. And this is in the 80s. And what was Fitzpatrick interested in? Well, he says, okay, we have this operator map, set values map here. And we simply say phi of t from Rn cross Rn to R plus infinity. So he's not really worrying about functions in that sense, but we have to add plus infinity. And this is defined by phi t of x and x star. And this is the supremum over all elements in the graph of our set valued map. And this is, well, x a star plus a x star minus a star. And this guy is called the Fitzpatrick function. And, well, Fitzpatrick has noted, if we know the Fitzpatrick function good enough, we can extend actually Lipschitz continuous functions. He just didn't know how it works. And this is where Bauschke and Wang come into play. They thought, okay, this Fitzpatrick function, what is this? This is the supremum of a family of functions, but what kind of functions are these? So for fixed A, this is a constant, and this is actually a linear map. So this is the supremum of a family of, well, affine functions. So that means phi t is convex. Well, this function might have values at infinity, and, well, we just use the usual rules for computing with plus or negative infinity to say, well, phi t is convex. And when we look at convex functions, then there is a very important conjugate, and it's called the Fenchel conjugate. And what does the Fenchel conjugate mean? We have, well, f star of x star is the supremum of all x in, let's say, Rn, and we have x x star minus f of x, and that's the Fenchel conjugate of So in general, we do not know anything about the Fenchel conjugate. Might even be a function which has values negative infinity or so. But if you look at convex functions, and these convex functions have some nice property that they are actually lower semi-continuous, or even better properties, then the Fenchel conjugate of such a function is again convex. So that is good news. And so we have here a conjugate operation, and we want to know, is this a nice operation? So there is an example. Well, let's say Q of x is simply 1/2 norm x squared. The nice, the half of the parabola there, then Q, the Fenchel conjugate of Q is actually Q. Direct computation can be easily computed. So, and what is the interesting construction of Bauschke and Wang? And this is called the proximal average of phi t and phi t star transpose. Well, I will explain this soon, what means transpose in this connection, with respect to this function Q. So how does this read? We have psi t of x, x star. And this reads as follows. This is the infimum over all y, y star plus z, z star equals x, x star. And over what? It's 1/2 the Fitzpatrick function evaluated at y, y star plus 1/2 its conjugate, but evaluated at z star z. This is the transpose. We just exchange those two things. So if I put here a t, then we just have z and z star, but this is how it looks like. And why is it called proximal? Because we take 1/4 of q, and this is y, y star minus z, z star. So this is the Bauschke and Wang construction. It's the proximal average of these two functions, and it's quite obvious that this function will help us to solve the Kirschbaum theorem if we know a little bit more about this guy here. So, and I can use this blackboard. So this is what Bauschke and Wang realized, that when we look at this guy, we are really happy, because we have the following theorem. So if f from Rn times Rn to R together with infinity is a proper, that just means that not all values of my function are infinity. That means proper, I have finite points in there. It's a proper, and then we have definable. That is where model theory comes into play. Convex function. And t from Rn to Rn is defined via f equals t plus identity minus 1. Then first observation, if what was it, phi t of x x star is equal to this guy, then t is monotone. So the Fitzpatrick function, our phi, if it satisfies, no, it's a greater or equal, this nice inequality, then t is monotone. So the clue is more or less, if you take this Fitzpatrick function, work a little bit, then you get to these nice inequalities. It's in principle only Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, just a couple of times. That makes it a little bit hard. And then, and this is the crucial observation, if phi t star x x prime is greater or equal x x star, then t is maximal. Well, these are two nice observations. So the Fitzpatrick function is really useful. And we see because it's Fitzpatrick function, it's Fenchel conjugate. And from this, we can decide whether we can really extend our Lipschitz continuous function using this guy here. So, but what is the real clue? This proximal average of the Fitzpatrick function, if you look at it closely, well, let's suppose that x and x prime are from the graph of Rt. Then we have here 1/2 of this Fitzpatrick function, and we have here also 1/2 of the conjugate. Well, this is something not too simple, but one can always show this is greater or equal, 1/2 y prime plus 1/2 z prime. This is nothing else than so-called Fenchel inequality, written down here. And, well, if you really look at this, we have this condition here. Oh, I made some small mistake. Here must be a 2. We have this condition here. And if we play a little bit with this function and so on, we see, well, this is actually always greater or equal than x and x prime. And if x and x prime or x star are from the graph of t, and well, if x and x prime are from the graph of t, then we have here equality for the whole stuff. And that means this function coincides on the graph of t with a Fitzpatrick function. So this is a nice function coinciding with a Fitzpatrick function on the graph of the operator. But what else has this proximal average? And this is Bauschke and Wang. We have that the proximal average and its conjugate is actually the same as psi, as the original function. We have here the transpose of the conjugate of the proximal average is actually the proximal average itself. So what does it mean with this nice theorem? Well, we know that T tilde from Rn times from Rn to Rn defined by x star in T tilde if x star is actually equal to the proximal average. So then this function actually, because we have here an equality, so think here of a psi, then we have here equality, that means that T tilde is monotone, and well, see the proximal average, its conjugate, while here we can switch these numbers for the dot product, it doesn't make any difference. So we still have also this inequality, we actually have equality, and then it's maximal. And the other thing is, we look at this function, and what do we see? Well, Q is definable. The Fitzpatrick function is also definable. Its Fenchel conjugate is definable. So everything is definable. And that means, yes, Kirsch-Brown theorem works in definably complete structures. Because as you have seen here, we only use supremum of things, and this works in definably complete structures. Of course, I have cheated a little bit in between, because not all things to compute this equality that Bauschke and Wang showed, that this is equal to that, works directly from the real numbers to real closed fields. There are some tricks and techniques, especially people from functional analysis like to use the word compact and the word limit of sequences. Well, translating this into definably complete setting, doing a little bit small changes and so on, one can translate this. And that's it.